before I go there, I'd just like to say briefly, so I did sort of switch my focus a little bit of this presentation and wanted to talk about our UU principles, and might there be some ways that we can figure out how to best operate in this complex sort of crazy making world that we're in these days. So the incident that started this for me was on February 2nd when I was at work and I received a text from my daughter. Hey, Mom, they say we're here at Cleveland High School breathing cadmium? What's this all about? And this, of course, was the start of the incident of bullseye glass, Ouroboros glass, air quality issues in southeast Portland, and which has since grown to be quite a, it's an ongoing saga, shall we say, of how we're going to respond to this. So when I got this text, and I first did a little bit of research, and I found that, yes, indeed, cadmium can be an endocrine-disrupting chemical. This is not good news. And I was furious. I was terrified, and I was furious. So this is what I composed but did not send. And this will be my on the pedestal thing here. Thanks for the heads up. My daughter, who's a junior at Cleveland High School, texted me about this announcement a bit ago. There wasn't any mention in your announcement about public schools being involved or that known potential exposures apparently have been occurring for months. The concern is not just acute or chronic toxicity where your dosage parameters might have some relevance. Both cadmium and arsenic are potential endocrine disruptors for which low dose effects and non-monotonic dose response curves are well known. Care here. I would have preferred to have information about potential exposure of my daughter to substances that can cause serious and irreversible harm several months ago, so I could have made decisions about whether my daughter and I wish to accept continued exposure and to assume the potential risks, rather than having this information withheld from the public and forcing my daughter to assume potentially serious irreversible consequences. I was upset. So the saga has continued. Massive community meetings were held. Hundreds of people showed up. And the vast divide between the professional risk assessors on one side and public perception of what's really going on and really is important here has continued. This wasn't, of course, the most recent episode. A few weeks after that, in the Portland Public Schools, we discovered, lo and behold, that there had been known incidents of lead in drinking water throughout the school system. It had been known for decades, and nothing had been done about it. A similar course of action, just as the DEQ director ended up resigning, the superintendent of the Portland Public Schools system ended up resigning, and that is now an ongoing saga in our own community. These two incidents, of course, happened with the backdrop of Flint, Michigan. Have people heard about Flint, Michigan, where the Republican governor, and then we economize and run state government like a business, decided to save some money by switching over Flint's drinking water and failed to take the additional measure to keep lead from leaching from the pipes and into the water. And despite protests and concerns for days and weeks and months and even years, only recently has the situation begun to be addressed. So it's clearly not just an isolated incident here and there. It's something that is endemic throughout our system. But yet, as I think about these issues about environmental health, we all have shared weekly here our reactions and our experiences and our concern about threats to the sort of social fabric in America today. The mass shootings, individual black men. I'm sorry, Lois? mass shootings of individuals, mass shootings by individuals, shootings of individual black men by police officers, shootings of police officers by individuals in the communities that they serve. What is this all about? It's not just our community and our nation. It spreads to Europe and the world. Terrorist attacks, immigration and refugee crises, war zones. My daughter and I were fortunate enough to be able to go to Europe during June and early July. We were in Britain as the Brexit vote was made, and we arrived in Greece just as the horrible attack on the airport in Istanbul took place. So some of these incidences begin to feel as if you're very much a part of this global community. So how in the world of UUs are we supposed to live in this world? How do we make sense of this craziness and this patchwork of what's going on? There's sort of a smorgasbord of principles out there. There's certainly a smorgasbord of problems. And so I started to think about some of our experiences and wondering if there might be a couple of guiding principles or touchstones that we could think about as you use that might be helpful in sort of navigating through this and really making a difference. So I want to talk about two things. One thing is root causes or common causes of some of these problems. It's sort of the what do we work on? And the second thing I want to talk about gets back to the precautionary principle or the benefit of the doubt. How do we go about making decisions once we decide what we're going to work on? So it's kind of a meaty topic, but I'll talk a little bit about it, and hopefully there'll be time for questions or comments if any of you have things to add to this conversation. So going back to the root causes of the commonality business, we seem to have one principle promoting and affirming the interdependent web of which we all are a part. And we also have promoting and affirming the inherent worth and dignity of every individual. These are great goals. It's the world out here and the social world over here. And the more I thought about and looked at some of these, and I've been in conversations and committee meetings and fellowship discussions and so on, it almost feels like we have to choose. Should we work on which principle should we work on? Which kind of cause should we promote? And are there conflicts, or are we really deciding or just discrediting one and giving too much emphasis to the other and so on? But the more I thought about some of this, I think we might be able to find some common root causes. Take, for example, climate change and some of our work on safer chemicals. Some of the environmental health issues, certainly lead we've worked on. Green Sanctuary Committee has worked on a lot of issues of trying to keep harmful substances out of products, bisphenol A out of baby products and so on. We did, and whereas we think of climate change as 350.org and chemical policy reform as safer states and TSCA reform, are there really some commonalities here? I went back to some of the work that Dr. Theo Hogerin prepared. She is the author, quite some years ago now, of Our Stolen Future and the scientist that first hypothesized about endocrine disrupting chemicals. And she wrote a short paper called The Fossil Fuel Connection. And if you think about it, fossil fuels, oil and coal and gas, as they come out of the ground, are, yes, they contribute to climate change. 350.org is a way to approach. But a good portion of petroleum products as they are extracted go to producing the very products that create problems. They're the feedstocks that produce plastic, the feedstocks that produce pesticides, the feedstocks that produce so many chemical substances that are a true problem in the world. So if we reframe how we look at this a little bit, if we work on climate change issues and we're looking at safer chemical issues, there's a root cause there of fossil fuels. We can frame our work that way. I'd like to take a second example, and that is sometimes we feel if we're working on climate justice or safer chemical issues, that's somehow separate from or different from or in competition with working on racial justice issues or social issues. But I'd like to also challenge us to think a little bit differently about that as well. And the example I'd like to use is Freddie Gray. Now, how do we think about the Freddie Gray situation, the black man who died while in police custody? We tend to think of it through a social justice frame, maybe a racial justice, socioeconomic frame. And indeed, the principle of equal worth and dignity for every person is an obvious frame for looking at this. But what's the other side of Freddie Gray's story? There's a easily accessed picture of Freddie Gray. He's a small boy. He's maybe 2 or 3 years old. He's cute as a button. He's just a sweet child. But where is this picture taken? It's in his living room. And what do you see in the background? Paint. Or rather, not paint. Peeling paint. Paint chips all over the floor, the windowsill peeling completely. Freddie Gray had huge high levels of lead in his blood from the time he was born through his whole childhood. Lead is a neurotoxin. Lead affects the ability of people to think. People who have lead exposure have ADHD. They're unable to concentrate. They behave differently. They are unable to cognitively process information. You are a different person if you've been exposed to lead at these levels. And Freddie Gray was just one of thousands and thousands of children growing up in the projects that were affected to this level by this toxic substance. And indeed, we can't have an equal worth and dignity of every person if you're living in a contaminated environment with contaminants in your system that affect who you very are and limit your potential for growth and development and contributions to society. So the media tends to look at this through a black and white or police and community frame. But really, there's a backstory here. There's an equally important story about environmental justice is racial justice, and racial justice is environmental justice. You can take the same frame and think about the black man who grew up in situations where there were contaminants in his environment due to socioeconomic condition, and he happened to grow up with asthma. When he was apprehended by the police, he said, "I can't breathe," when he was put in a chokehold. And they didn't believe him, and they mocked him, and he died. It's a similar kind of a frame. We look at this, is that just a social justice, or is that also root causes are there in environmental justice and not having clean and uncontaminated places to live in? So I offer that as a second root cause, a different frame, a way to think about these things. And I'm going to offer a third example. I know we're sort of galloping along here in issues, but we're going to gallop along to a third out of three examples. And this is, again, going back whether it's climate change or safer chemicals. I've kind of wrapped all this up together in racial justice. We've got all this over here. And what exactly is the relationship, particularly between climate change and all of this violence and terrorism and war that's going on? It was, you know, sort of progress. Every time I opened up the newspaper, there's a publication called Above the Fold that the Environmental Health Service is a nonprofit organization, puts out. They don't make any news. They just compile news from all around the world. You know, every day the past couple weeks, I would open up my Above the Fold, and I found something I wanted to reference in this talk. So, but the one that came out the past couple of days was a new study from the National Academy of Sciences. And they went back and looked at climate and conflict around the world from 1980 to 2010. So this is actual data, and there's enough that they can do, like, statistically significant things with it. It's not just happenstance. And they discovered there is an extremely strong correlation between climate change and war, climate change and conflict, particularly in countries where there's an ethnically divided population. So this isn't just speculation anymore that climate change, the interdependent web of which we all are a part when it starts fraying, that can lead to situations where you inherently don't have an equal worth and dignity of every person, you know, violence, conflict, and war. War is, of course, one of the greatest environmental polluters ever. So as I sort of spun the experience of the past few months, in my perception, I really started to think a little bit more about what are some of the common root causes, and is it really in competition when we're working on different principles or working on different projects, or can we look a little bit deeper and find a common ground where we can work in ways that really promote many causes, rather than seeing them as separate, looking for the root causes or the commonalities. So with that to say about root causes and commonalities, the next question, the second question I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about is sort of now that we kind of know what we're working on and how it might be connected, how do we decide what we're going to do when we approach these issues? And this is what I might call who gets the benefit of the doubt question. In terms of one answer, is the precautionary principle. So I'd like to take just a few minutes and sort of outline, we have two basic approaches for how to decide when we don't know for sure. In the United States, particularly in environmental health issues, we take an approach, and I'll just pick a label that might resonate with people, risk management. What is risk management all about? It basically requires proof of harm. Think playbook for the tobacco industry, all the way from the tobacco industry to the climate deniers. We don't have enough proof of harm yet. We just don't know for sure. Merchants of Doubt, what's the other book? Doubt is their product. If we're in a risk management situation, we must have proof of harm before we can act. So who gets the benefit of the doubt? People? Chemicals? Right. So chemicals or radiation or whatever gets the benefit of the doubt. There could be a huge conversation around this, but I'll give a couple of examples of how effective risk management is. I have, do folks remember a situation called Three Mile Island? Three Mile Island was 1979 in Pennsylvania, release of a meltdown, partial meltdown of a nuclear reactor, and the release of radioactive material into the air and onto the vegetation and into the wildlife and the soil and the waters and so forth. When I was in college, law school, years after this incident had occurred, I stumbled across a case that I could not believe. Judge Sylvia Remmel in Pennsylvania District had made a decision, and she made a decision that almost none of the plaintiff's evidence met was up to snuff to be admitted to find any liability on behalf of Three Mile Island. And I haven't tracked down the ultimate result of all the various cases, but it's my understanding that very little, if any, compensation was ever paid to anybody because they really couldn't prove harm. They really couldn't prove that this particular harm was caused by that particular release and the complexity. And their efforts to develop some models to show causation for this particularly unique situation were thrown out because obviously it had only been developed for this situation. So unless you have multiple meltdowns, there's no way that you could ever cause harm, okay? The other example, how many people remember Bhopal in India? Union Carbide, this is 1984, release of poisonous gas into the communities. Thousands of people were killed immediately, and thousands of others have persevered for decades with blindness, with respiratory issues, with there's a whole population of people who are still around who are affected by this. And I couldn't believe it, earlier this year I found reports of a case, the final case in that particular series, talking about compensation for these victims, and there was to be no compensation. The corporation had managed to offload their liability to a subsidiary that had no money or something along those lines. But it really made me realize how effective this risk management approach is, requiring proof of harm, and coupled with the mechanisms that the powerful institutions in our society have of managing their own risks by putting it off onto somebody else. So, leaving that as a very sketchy discussion of the risk management approach that we have in the United States, this finally gets us around to the topic of the talk here, which is the precautionary principle. In the European Union, over the past 10 to 15 years, there's been a very robust discussion and debate around what is this risk management proof of harm approach really about, and do we value that as a society? What's the alternative? Well, the alternative would be basically to have proof of safety, or we're going to start with the assumption that this might be a bit of a problem. We want to make sure we've really vetted it, we've really thought about it and worked it through before we allow that particular chemical to be released or technology to be used or process to be implemented. And so in the precautionary approach, who gets the benefit of the doubt? People! Absolutely. So, and in the sort of drawing some contrast, as opposed to these long drawn-out cases which essentially have no accountability for harm caused, the opposite end of that spectrum in the European Union, we're now looking at things like early warning systems, not just looking for proof of harm in the past, but beginning to look at a lot of the systems we have out there now for early warning. And some of the roots might be in climate issues like tsunamis or earthquakes, but extending that to things like infectious diseases, other kinds of, you know, phenomena that we can now gather information on electronically, other aspects like citizen science, we can gather a lot of information and instantly compile it through electronics and phones and so on. We have so much that we can do, so much that we can glean from what's going on in the world to really start thinking creatively, not just what are our current problems, but trying to project some of those problems and begin to get ahead of the curve and act in a way that is truly precautionary and preventive of future problems. So, I think what I'd like to do is this. I'd like to conclude with a quote from Dr. Theo Colburn, who sort of summarizes some of this for me. I know we've been sort of across a big spectrum here of, you know, incidents that affect us personally, the things that are going on in the world, and maybe a little bit about root causes and how do we decide. But I think Theo really, really began to pull this together, and this was a part of an article produced in 2000 for Architects of Peace. Peace begins in the womb. The newborn reflects this truth. Order is transferred from cell to tissue to organs to organisms to families, communities, and nations. Unfortunately, when development is violated in the womb, the newborn is compromised. Such exposure can lead to reduced intelligence, discontent, failure, and the inability to socially integrate. Man-made chemicals deprive societies of responsible leaders and thinkers. The social and economic impacts are incalculable. Disregard for the environment has been rampant on a global scale. And this was written in the year 2000. Now, as we come to the end of the 20th century, we are suddenly faced with the realization that wherever we have destroyed the environment, we have left behind desperation, hunger, fear, and strife. When society takes heed and spends more on infrastructures for prevention than on remediation and healing, stability and integrity can be restored. So I'd like to close by quoting one of the paragraphs from the reading that I thought was it resonated with me, particularly being a UU, and what religion as a UU can bring to these battles. Let religion be to us the wonder and lure of that which is only partly known and understood, an eye that glories in nature's majesty and beauty, and a heart that rejoices in deeds of kindness and of courage. May it be so.
Thank you, Cheyenne. We have a lot of good time for questions, and there probably will be quite a few. I will get around to you.
Cheyenne, every time you give a talk, I am enlightened. And your last one was about leadership from bottom up, and I wanted to know so much more about it. My question is, are we the only ones who are hearing what you had to say, or are you doing a book or something to fill in these things, because the information is so timely?
Gosh, that's a nice thing for you to say, Laura. Thank you. Well, I will say I work at the Department of Environmental Quality. My job is in the happy corner of the EQ. I don't work directly with the folks who are involved with this air quality business, for example. But there is and it's not just the EQ, it's regulatory agencies, state and federal. I hear things like, well, we really don't want to regulate until the science is settled. And in my reading of things, that's a formula for not moving forward at all. So I'm puzzling myself is there a way I can help do positive change within this sort of environment, or does one sort of step outside of that and try to capture this? we'll talk more.
Thanks, Cheyenne. Again, I learned from you, and I do appreciate that. I have a bunch of things to say, but I'll simplify it. I get the sense that even at a state level, we don't do anything because we're waiting for someone else to do it. There seems to be a delay tactic. And a couple of times I've reported things to state agencies when nothing happened. And one I want to alert people about is a product, if I can get the name right, TriFloScan. It's using antiseptic soaps and stuff, and it is highly allergenic, creates asthma and things. I reported to the state agency, and they said, we're not going to do anything until that's up to the federal government. That's one of the things I see. Can we do something at a local level that then impacts the rest of the world, country?
I think that's a great observation, Paul, and thank you. I think one of the bright spots perhaps to come out of this whole air quality issue, the bullseye issue in Southeast Portland, it really did lead to an overwhelming sort of sweep of citizen involvement in community meetings of hundreds of people. The director of DEQ resigned. The Environmental Quality Commission is now re-engaged. They've been sort of dormant for a while for all practical purposes. They're conducting a national search for a new DEQ director. with criteria, you know, hoping to kind of hit the reset button and start changing some of the attitudes, both the regulated community and the public. And the governor's involved, the congressional delegation is involved, but for the first time in many years, there might be momentum to really get people involved. You know, those of us of sort of my age, weight and grade, want to say, well, we did as what we could, you know, 20, 30 years ago. Now it's time for a new generation to step up and step into the fight and pick up the battle and carry it on from here. It's not all done yet. And yeah, you know, you're right. You take one issue in this whole array of how we look at things, and it's really hard to figure out how to get traction. In the European Union, the nonprofits and government agencies and scientists really did engage in a decade-long debate on, is risk management really getting the job done, or is society's values really better preserved by adopting the precautionary principle, which is enshrined in the EU way of going about things. So you start out with giving people the benefit of the doubt and requiring more information and proof of safety of chemicals, for example, all chemicals, not just triclosan or microbeads or nanotechnology or all of these other substances and technologies with unknown benefits. So, you know, finding, you know, what is it, a lever, and I can move the word, but where's the fulcrum? How do you get started on these conversations? I guess that's one of the reasons when the clipboard came around months ago, I was like, I don't know what I'm going to say, but I've got to, you know, I've got to take another run at this. I've got to try. Thank you.
Thank you, Cheyenne. As a follow-up to Paul's question, I just wondered, do you know if DEQ and other regulatory agencies have been discussing the precautionary principle in the last 10 years? I mean, they've obviously been aware that the European Union has decided to take that approach. So does it come up and it get dismissed, or is it a topic for retreats and then we go back to business as usual on Monday, or what do you think?
That's a great question. One of the things about environmental regulation, our environmental regulatory framework was adopted like 30 years ago, and it's media-specific, land, air, water, and we have these different programs, and embodied in that whole regulatory framework is risk management. It's become enshrined in part by decisions of the courts, as if we can manage this risk. We have sort of little outposts where precaution can be discussed. At DEQ, we have a cross-agency team called Toxics Reduction Team. They were active for a while and then kind of went away, but they've been reactivated, I think, as part of this whole controversy and rethinking about what do we want to ask for, you know, environmental quality and public health. So I'd like to think that our Toxics Reduction Team is sort of a core, a little seed that can grow into something more meaningful. And we also have a newly renovated and reactivated sustainability team. So they're little bright spots within our agency framework. And I think because right now we're operating with an interim director, so it's kind of a holding pattern, you know. and I think we'll just have to see once the new director gets on and things go by. Yeah. Good question. Thank you, Megan.
This is Katie Hettinger. I have a question about who makes up, where do they find the people that go into your agency? I have friends that work in Washington on health, and a lot of those people come out of the drug industry, and they go back into the drug industry, so they have an interest, you know, outside of the national interest in the status quo. Where do the people who work with you come from, and where do they go when they're not working with you?
That's a real interesting question. A lot of people at DEQ, I mean, I work with a lot of people who have been there 20, 25, 30 years. Incredible number of people are retiring. So we're beginning to go through a transformation. So a lot of people came to DEQ at an EPA level as well. You know, straight out of their training back in, what, the 1970s, 80s, whatever, and there they still are. And have kept the frameworks from those times. It's only now that we're beginning to have some openings and bringing in people from outside. Because over the course of my career in nonprofits and law, I applied to DEQ every 5 years or so for a couple of decades, and I was never selected. I was always the runner-up, never the bride, because I always selected somebody from internally to, you know, keep rotating the same people around with the same skill sets and the same. I have to be careful, I guess, since I'm still employed. Huh? But that's just the way it is. When I first started at DEQ, I was the first one to come from outside as headquarters in forever. people looked at me with suspicion, you're not one of us. So it's been a real interesting shift to see some new people coming in with some new frame. These people have degrees in sustainability and green building and food service systems. They have whole different frames and upgraded skills and frameworks for thinking and looking at things. So at least at DEQ, we don't have that kind of a revolving door. So one of the senior staff people who was involved in the original public PR release that I found so unsatisfactory on the air quality issue that I started with my response to, had already taken a job with a major polluter in the state. So, you know, it's not to say that there aren't, you know, crossovers and innuendos, but somebody who has the professional skills, you know, sometimes will move from academia to government to corporate. That's kind of a rambling response, but I'll leave it at that.
Thank you so much for your giving us a kind of a view of what's a huge, larger topic. Three quick points. One is, I really enjoyed both the book and the movie, A Civil Action, which really talks about how these issues really run through our legal system in the real world and how daunting it can be. The second thing is that you've alluded to a small aspect of the huge difficulty of the interface between science and public policy, and there are so many people who seem to be questioning science as a way of looking at the world that I'm kind of, it's very disturbing, and there are issues that we need to be kind of grappling with, not just climate change, but GMOs and vaccines and so forth, where that issue
happens. Who gets the benefit of
that? And anything that can help us understand this process better benefits us all. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I think that's an excellent point, and I think this whole who gets the benefit of the doubt, the chemicals or people, basically. And one side, the scientists would say we're avoiding a type one error. We want to, above all costs, avoid erroneously concluding that A causes B. Nope, don't have enough proof. Tobacco doesn't cause smoking, but carbon doesn't cause climate. But, and on the other side, the precautionary side, the scientists would say we're trying to avoid a type two error. We're going to assume that there's a connection there until somebody shows us they're not. So we live in a world where good science is avoiding type one errors. And that's been taken as a foundation for public policy, which gives the chemicals the benefit of the doubt and makes it impossible to make any meaningful progress. Good science, from a particular science point of view, you want to avoid type 1 errors. From a public policy point of view, you might want to avoid type 2 errors and give people the benefit of the doubt and proceed a little bit more carefully. But somehow in our constructs, even Hillary said, I'm for good science or whatever, which is too much taken because people don't understand that that's a scientific term, and when you translate it into public policy, it might not make any sense at all. Good science, technically avoiding type 1 errors, is a disaster when it comes to chemicals, carbon, all these things that we meaningfully deal with. But it's really hard to have conversations with people about two-by-two frames, which I've done before. Pascal's wager, I've done that presentation. But yes, that's absolutely right. You try to reclaim, it's almost trying to reclaim what science and what good science is all about. It's crucial to somehow broadening the discussion and having some alternatives.
Hi, thank you. I'm thinking about the Zika virus, and I don't know a lot, but it does seem to me that there's lots of answers now. I mean, we know the vector, mosquito, and I guess they've almost got a vaccine. That's what I heard lately. But I also understand that the help powers that be asked for an amount of money to work on prevention, work on the vaccine, and Congress got into their usual hang-up and didn't award any money or didn't pass that request for money on. I'm also thinking about Zika and the connection to global warming. Heating up caused more mosquitoes or whatever, who knows. Hey, what do you know about that? Especially that money part. Do you know anything about the money that had been asked for and Republicans wanted to tie something else to the bill and Democrats wouldn't have any of that, so the money didn't get awarded.
Yeah, I think these things are also obviously politicized, and particularly in election year, and I think it can really be sort of a lack of understanding, and it can also be a not wanting to understand. It almost gets into some of the climate denier realm, where we don't care what the consequences are, we're just going to pursue our political agenda. And yes, I did see some recent articles on more and more seeing the connection between climate change and, for example, infectious diseases and vectors and how things spread in the community. So I think there's really, once again, a more comprehensive approach. Thanks for raising those.
Thank you, Cheyenne, for a very informative talk.